Within this old house live two residents. One of them is John Russell, composer, professor. The other has been dead for over 70 years.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome, everybody, to another especially creepy episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on filmscorerejects.com.
Do we really want, when we have a friend in the show, do we want to refer to it as an extra creepy episode?
It is an extra creepy episode.
Like, you know, hide your children, hide your wife.
Considering the last time you adopted the hashtag friend of the show, I think we can go deep and we can go creepy with it. So that's what we're going to do today on filmscorerejects.com, the weekly cult and exploitation filmcast that is so good, it just has to be fattening, right here on filmscorerejects.com. If you would like to hear more of this show, you can always go to iTunes, you can go to Stitcher, you can go to any of your favorite podcasting services and find our back catalog of episodes. You can find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can also like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, kiddies, Junk Food Cinema. And tonight, we are joined by a very special guest. I'm so excited by this. I think this is our first guest of 2017.
This is like our first episode we've recorded in 2017.
That's not the point, Kurgle. The point is, first special guest of 2017. This is the milestone.
Let's make it super special.
Let's make it super special in a very fun way. Our guest tonight is a local Austin Arthur.
Arthur?
He's I'm drink all your drinks. I'm a local Austin Arthur.
I'll alert the media.
Description. Is it? He's just chucking little dogs into rivers.
He is our small, adorable little drunken Austinite, so that's not really the furthest from the truth.
He's a local Austin author. He is also a local Austin director and a screenwriter, Mr. Owen Edgerton. How are you, sir?
Hi, I'm fine.
Yeah. No. Owen is a, we talk about friend of the show, and Owen is a good friend of the show. Owen is one of those Austin guys who's been around forever. If you live in Austin, there's a good chance you've seen him introduce a show. He does stand-up comedy. He, you know, has done Master Pancake, which used to be called Mr. Sinus before, I think, lawyers got involved.
Were you there for the Mr. Sinus days?
What? Yes!
Are you kidding? He's part of Mr. Sinus Theater 3000.
God damn it,
you're playing it, Greg?
Yeah, no. He was there for when the lawyers showed up. Like, that's a whole story that he can tell. So he's been around. He's been writing. He's been, you know, making movies. He's been, you know, doing the screenwriting work and
seducing the art world.
In fact, you have. Yeah. And you're one of these guys. Like, our paths have crossed for like 15 years. Yeah. And until we eventually like became good friends and started sitting around drinking scotch together. Yeah. As you're supposed to do when you're a writer.
As is tradition.
And so here we are drinking scotch, talking about one of my favorite fucking movies, which you suggested. And I was like, yes, we need to talk about this. It's been on the short list to do for a very long time.
I can't believe you guys haven't done it before, actually.
It's a little baffling that we haven't, but it is a movie we've talked about on a number of different episodes, just kind of in the periphery.
It's a movie that played into, as we'll talk about, played into the inspiration of Sinister.
Yeah.
Like, when we were writing Sinister, this movie came up. It is a movie that has been in my DNA for so long, and I think this is one of those movies we kept saying, we'll do it for Halloween, and then we always did, like, theme Halloweens.
But, you know, it is one of those ones, too, and we haven't even said what the movie is, but no. It is one of those ones.
But it's at on the title of the podcast, so it's not like people are surprised.
No, no one's gonna be
surprised. Sometimes we're like, hey, we're going to keep this close to our vest for as long as possible, and then it's like, motherfucker, it was in the headline that you fucking linked to. Yeah. You had a picture from the movie. Like, we're not fucking shocked, asshole.
I'm not wearing a vest. But
I'm not wearing pants.
But it is one of those movies too. Like, it's like, so I suggested this one or The Haunting, right? The Haunting, you have to watch The Haunting. Like, film students have to watch everything like that. It's out there in numerous different formats and everything, and streaming. It's had its remake and everything like that. But The Changeling is hard to find. I mean, I actually went to look for it. I was like, oh, well, I'm going to watch it again. I haven't seen it in a while. I went to Vulcan. They're like, oh, our copy walked. We didn't even know. We don't have it on the shelf. And I went onto all the streaming places, and you couldn't find any. You can buy a DVD, if you know, but you can't. It's not even out there streaming right now. It's like, which is a weird state of where films are today. Because, like, if I live in a town that doesn't have a good rental place, luckily in Austin we do, we have a couple of them, then what are you going to do? You might miss The Changeling. There's a whole generation of young people who don't even know who George C. Scott is.
No, and it's true. And it's that this movie was my go-to whenever I'd have, because when video stores existed and truly existed, like we have the great few stores we have left.
Yeah.
But
when they're everywhere.
But yeah, video stores now are for people our age who are going, you know, who are hardcore movie, you know, cinephiles, who are going and looking for that oddball, like, selection. Like, I really want to watch Sallow, 120 Days of Sodom, and where do I find that?
Well, you want to watch it once for each of the 120 Days of Sodom.
Exactly. So you know, you go in looking for that, but in the glory days of video stores, you know, every October you'd have about a dozen times where a pair of giggling teenage girls would come in and they'd be like, we're watching horror movies.
Yeah.
And we are looking for something really scary. And you name up a couple of things. Have you seen The Exorcist? Yes. Have you seen The Omen? Yes. We're looking for something that's really scary you've never heard of. And then you go, have you seen The Changeling? And you pull it out and they go, no. What's The Changeling? And it's like, this is a movie that I've watched grown man wet themselves to. And they're like, oh, and I'm not lying.
Yeah.
Like, this movie is legitimately scary as fuck. It is a great scary movie that sadly shows its age in terms of it's been ripped off so many times.
It's been ripped off so many times. We'll get to The Conjuring, aren't we?
Because we'll get to several movies that rip it off. But the thing is that this is such a great performance movie. This is such a great horror movie. And it's a movie you can sit down with adults in the dark and be legitimately creeped out and scared by, even if you're like, yeah, the story sounds similar to a number of big recent horror films over the last 20 years. This movie stands as one of those greats.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I will give it this testament. I've seen this movie several times. I owned it on DVD. I didn't have to worry about the dearth of streaming options, but watching
rich
it,
guy bragging about his DVD collection.
We get it. You can afford DVDs. But I watched it, and I went to bed immediately thereafter and was unsettled. I did not have a restful slumber because I went into bed. It was dark. It was quiet in the apartment. I was just like, oh, this is one of those things where as a horror fan, you kind of pray for that you still have the ability to have an experience like this, because I think as horror fans, sometimes we get so desensitized that we're just like, yeah, whatever, and we go straight to sleep. This movie still, you know, putting aside the fact that it was made in 1980,
mm-hmm.
and putting aside the fact that George C. Scott is a star and that I am 32 years old, I watched this movie again, knowing full well how creepy it is, and it still made my slumber a little uneasy.
Yeah, dude, the scene that ball comes down the staircase...
Oh.
Is just, holy shit, the first time people see that, that fucking scares the shit out of people. And it's so simple. And conceptually, like, you sit there as a grown-ass adult who knows how to tell stories, and you're like, that's so fucking simple. I know exactly, like, I can all but see the guy off camera rolling the ball down the stairs. But dear fucking Christ, the pacing of that movie, the tone of that movie, the execution of that scene is fucking scary.
Yeah. There's, like, some things... Rewatching it, I was like, wow, there's things being done that you wouldn't point out as a scare that are so good. There's such good sound design in that movie. The sound design is like 90% of that movie is some great stuff there. And then there's some like wild camera angles. It is kind of like, it's 1980 and it's an American film, but if I'm right, the director's British. I think he's British.
It was actually made mostly in Canada.
And
the
scariest of countries.
The scariest of countries. And they shot mostly in Canada with a few facades in Seattle, because that's where the movie is technically based, is Seattle. Even though it is based on the true story of a haunted house in Colorado, it was set in Seattle and filmed mostly in Canada. So, I mean, it has that going for it. We've talked about this several times, about when a movie was made versus when it feels like it was made.
Yeah.
This is a movie made in 1980 that feels like it was made in 1975.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. It's like, it definitely, like, it's in the 80s, but it's totally 70s.
Well, yeah, it's got that.
It's like Don't Look Now.
Yeah.
You know, it has that kind of aesthetic quality to it.
It feels British. There's like a British.
Well, that's because it's a film that is very slowly paced. It is a character drama with one of the greatest actors ever to live. Let's just throw that out right now.
I don't know what you're talking about.
George C. Scott is not only one of the greatest actors ever to live, probably one of the greatest alpha males ever to live. Like, he's a man so fucking alpha male, the night he was up for an Oscar, he stayed home to watch a hockey game because fuck that. I don't need your fucking award. Like, because he didn't, because he was George C. fucking Scott and he wanted to watch a fucking hockey game on television. Not he had tickets. He wanted to sit at home and drink and watch hockey, because that's who the fuck George C. Scott was.
I was watching this movie and I was thinking, Cargill wants to grow up to be George C. Scott in this movie. That's who Cargill hopes to become.
I wanted to grow up to become George C. Scott, period. Like, dude, this guy was the fucking man, and boy does he bring everything to bear here. The principal story here is, this is about a guy who has just lost his wife and son. Oh, yeah. He cannot get over it. He's entirely heartbroken. They were his whole world. He's a master composer. He has been invited to a college to teach composition and be the guest lecturer for a while. He's living in the guest lecturer home, which is this fantastic fucking huge mansion that they've got, that they can't get rid of because it's got a notorious history.
Because it doesn't want people.
It doesn't want people.
Yeah, he's renting it from the Historical Society.
Yes.
It's been empty for 12 years.
Pro tip, guys, pro tip. If you are paying rent to the Historical Society and not to a landlord, move the fuck out of that house.
There are problems here.
Except it's a beautiful Historical Society person there. So
no, it's great and all, but you will be the fuck haunted.
Oh, no, he was talking about the person.
Oh, no, yeah, that's great. No, I get it.
But so while he's staying there...
That was the Tinder of the 80s, I get it, but I'm just saying, you're going to run into problems.
So while he's staying there, weird shit starts happening, and I'm going to say not only weird shit starts happening, weird iconic shit starts happening, because quite literally this movie took very simple things, turned scares out of them, and the things that they made scary have not been ripped off. As much as the story here has been ripped off, there's a whole group of sequences involving a child's wheelchair that this movie fucking owns. Nobody will touch it. Nobody will do the child wheelchair thing again, because that's like, no, that's treading on the sacred ground. Like, the story's been, and to be fair, and we'll get into the story, because the story actually kind of borrows from a story that had been written previously by another great writer we've talked about in the past. But it is, it has these sequences that just like this. That sequence, the ball sequence.
Let's talk about it. Like, things have been ripped off. Like, I mean, you're totally right. Like, the wheelchair and the camera work was going to be the other thing I was going to say. Like, the slow burn and the camera work is fucking fantastic. Really odd shots, really bizarre wide angles from bizarre places. It's really beautiful. And that POV from the chair in the third act and the climax is crazy. It's crazy, the chair chasing her down the hallway and everything. But you do have stuff that has been ripped off.
There's like the seance.
The seance, the ball, the seance, the music box. You remember there's a music box in this?
Yeah.
That plays on its own. Like, there's a lot of things that later movies, and I mean, I mock The Conjuring for this, but Conjuring does a great job of borrowing from every haunted house movie that's ever been made. It's like, we'll take the wind chimes. Oh, we'll take the ball. Oh, we'll take the piano. We'll take it all.
And while we're kicking The Conjuring in the nuts for half a second.
I mean, I like The Conjuring. I like The Conjuring.
But the thing is as much as it borrows and riffs on all of those, it actually created two of its own. and created two original horror things that will be ripped off from here on out. The sheet falling onto the body,
yep.
and then the hands coming out and clapping.
Yep.
Like, those two moments are so original and so fresh. Like, it was just, it was like, God damn it, I'm jealous of those moments. They're so good.
So good.
So while The Conjuring is ripping on that, I also feel like The Conjuring as a film is a film that's about riffing on this era and the films yeah. of this era. So I feel like it's not so much like ripping off as it is paying homage to these films that we are about to talk about.
I think that, what a great point. Like, watching The Conjuring as a new, so I watched it with my wife, who has not seen as many horror movies as I have. So I'm watching it, I'm going, oh, check, check. Yep. Oh, they're going to do that, check, cool. Oh, okay, they're going to do that too. And it was kind of fun. And also fun to see them do it well. I'm like, oh, wow, that's like seeing you quote, like in jazz, you just quoted a phrase and you did it really well. You put your own personality on it, but I recognize where you're, who you're quoting. But for Jodie, who has not seen all these movies, she's like, oh my, fuck, there's a ball.
The ball is so good.
Yeah.
The ball is so good.
And I want to say this too. As far as a movie that was made in 1980 that feels very much a product of the 70s, that opening, so bleak. So, like, I don't think Peckinpah gets this bleak. Like, it affected me. And I don't know if it's because, you know, we've talked about this recently. I don't know if it's because I'm about to be a dad. I don't know. But, like, that fucking opening hit me so hard. And the fact that you watch that happen and then it's like, and opening credits.
Yeah. It's also, like, I'm totally with you. Because, like, and it's... The opening scene, for those guys who have not seen it, and a spoiler for the first 4 minutes of the movie, George C. Scott on vacation with his wife and daughter in some snowy locale. They're at the side of the road.
No, it's a daughter.
It is a daughter.
I thought that same thing, but then they kept saying afterwards, it's like, my daughter really liked this ball. My No, but I was with you. The way they dressed that kid at the beginning, I thought it was his son.
I've always thought it was a son.
It's a daughter.
I don't know why. I've seen this movie like 12 billion times.
I get the mistake.
So he's making a phone call to get some car help. A car and a truck go out of control on the snowy road and basically slam. And you see them slam into the wife and daughter. Ugh. And he is trapped in a phone booth. And they film it so wonderfully because you don't see his face exactly. You see him in the fogged up phone booth and he's unable to do anything. And it's smack. And what's great about it is we're watching a haunted house movie. We have not seen the house. We've not seen the origin of the haunting. Mm-hmm. All we've seen is the tragedy that has made this man open
and then
to the
we,
haunting.
And what's great about this movie is that the ensuing haunting has zero to do with his own tragedy.
Right. Except that he's open to it. Like there's one moment in the seance where she's like, you've experienced a terrible loss, so you're open to this or whatever. But yeah, that's right. Zero to do. It's really good.
And that's this is exactly the kind of supernatural movie that draws me in immediately, because you have somebody who their own tragedy sort of parallels what's going on in the house or juxtaposes it in a fun way, but it isn't the reason. Like, it would be so easy to just write something where the haunting has to do with his own tragedy, but the haunting of this particular house has to do with something that happened before he was even fucking born. And he just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, but receptive to supernatural influences in such a way that the onus is upon him to solve what is going on in this house.
Yeah. And this, now the thing is this idea has been riffed on many times since. This is the first film to really kind of nail this kind of story, although the story, I don't want to say it rips off. I'm guessing it was inspired by a Richard Matheson story that would be later turned into a film called Stir of Echoes.
I mean, I would like to believe that every supernatural movie is some way influenced by Richard Matheson,
as you guys have heard us talk about many times on the show. He's one of my favorite writers. He has written so much of the stuff that you guys love or inspired it, wrote I Am Legend and wrote Stir of Echoes.
I mean, we've stopped saying figure it out and just started saying do the Matheson.
But this is like Richard. You know what I've always felt this movie is? That this is Richard Matheson by way of Richard Donner.
Ooh.
Like, those are my pair of dicks for this movie. But no, this movie feels like you've been talking about, like, the way it looks and the way it's paced. It feels like a fucking Richard Donner movie. Like, it feels like The Omen.
This would be a really great double feature with The Omen, for sure.
Oh, I've watched it with The Omen. I've showed it to people with The Omen. Like, this is it.
Oh, creepy. I did it. I did it yesterday.
Dude, creepy kid movies that from the 70s, like, these are the two that are fucking, you know, it's the original Omen and this. Like, these are the ones that are like, holy fuck, these movies are going to creep people the fuck out. And the fact that they both take these anchored by these amazing seasoned actors. Like, because this movie, the thing about this film, the thing about Changeling is... the movie is about George C. Scott's suffering. It's about his suffering over the loss of his family and him using this mystery of this ghost to try to find healing. At first, he's thinking he's communicating with his own child, only to figure out that this is this other child, for as you were saying, from so long ago, and that he wants the mystery to be solved. Like, this is the ring without the, you weren't supposed to let her out. Like, this is that story.
This is the ring before VCRs were a thing.
Yeah. So, well, yeah. So watching him kind of start to, like, when he reaches that crescendo where he just can't take it anymore from the ghost and he's like, what do you want from me? And then he realizes, oh, you want me to solve this mystery.
But not in a Jennifer Love Hewitt, what are you waiting for? You know, I know what you did last summer sort of way, but in a real human.
You didn't have to say, I know what you did last summer. Everyone knew what you said when you said, Jennifer Love Hewitt.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think there's more connection there than you're willing to admit. I think...
to Jennifer Love Hewitt?
Yeah.
Well, dear God, yes.
I mean, George C. Scott is a ghost whisperer. I don't know if he's the ghost whisperer, but I don't know that I would relate those two things. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And one of the things that's so great about this movie is that through most of it, the conversations, it's so deliberately truncated. The conversations in the early part of this movie are things like, how are you liking the house? Oh, fine, fine. End of discussion. And there are so many conversations that end that way where...
The question is that brilliant writing? Is that brilliant editing? Or is that George C. Scott going, I'm only doing half of these lines today?
I want to believe the former, but maybe you're right, it is the latter. I don't know. But I tend to believe it is a function of his grief. That he cannot engage in a human conversation for more than 5 minutes.
I 100% agree with you. I'm totally kidding about it. From everything I understand, George C. Scott was an amazingly giving actor who, like, was always there and committed. And we will make several jokes about him today, but only because we love and respect the fuck out of him.
Yeah.
And boy, for me, this is my favorite role of his. Like, yes, he's done much, you know, much bigger, more cinematic, well-remembered roles. Patton and, as you mentioned, Dr. Strangelove.
And let us not forget Rescuers Down Under.
Well, let us
say Exorcist 3, but...
We were going to get to Exorcist 3.
That's more apt to what we're talking about right now.
We were going to get to Exorcist 3 eventually, because Exorcist 3, wow, is that the good comeback from a terrible sequel?
Oh, yeah.
Like, that is the gold standard of great third movies. That and Nightmare on Elm Street, Dream Warriors.
For sure.
And Season of the Witch, just throwing
whoa,
it out there.
Wow, okay.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah,
oh yeah. We're good because we'll go there because we will.
What are these gloves on the floor doing here?
But so he's so great here, and yeah, those clipped conversations like that like he's very disturbed and off by himself, and this movie's very quiet.
Do you remember the scene? It's probably my favorite part where it overlaps his grief with the haunting that. They do a flash again of the death of his wife and daughter, and it's obviously a dream because he wakes up at 6 a.m. and he's just weeping in bed. Yeah. He's alone and weeping in bed, and it's like there's just nothing, just this guy. And like that gets me in the same way you're talking about, like becoming a dad. I'm like, I'm a dad. I'm like, oh my God, yeah, so alone.
Look at these spawners over on that side of the
spawners.
Room.
Spawners. You on your couch with your scotch.
Yeah, I see you joke like he's reclining on his couch with his scotch and no children. No, that's exactly what's fucking happening right now.
That's not an exaggeration.
Like, you guys get to go home and put your kids to bed, and I'm going to play video games with my wife and make golden shower Trump jokes all night. That's... Because that's today.
That's right.
That's topical.
By the time you post this, that the arc will be done. They'll be like, we're so over P. We're over P.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like there'll be those little spurts after and you'll have to shake off. I think that'll still be going on.
That's okay.
All right, back to the fucking changeling. For fuck's sake, let's
Let's talk about this. And so, right after that, when he's crying, then the big bong bong bong. He hears the second time he's heard the banging coming, and he starts to investigate. This was something I really liked in this movie that I was really impressed with. Is the investigation that happens? Like, it really works. So I love The Haunting. Right, The Haunting, my favorite haunted house.
Well, I mean, it is quite literally the novel that changed the face of horror.
Yeah. And he's referring to the original adaptation, yes. Not the Owen Wilson, like, oh, hey.
Wait. Who would have actually thought?
There's a giant lion falling at me. I should probably get out of this fireplace.
Oh, Jesus Christ. It is. He's clearly rehearsed that, which is like, why did I not know he had an Owen Wilson ready to go? Because we probably would have pulled one or
because
two
because we were either going to talk about the Haunting or Anaconda on any given episode, so I was ready to go with that. In the chamber.
Very good. Nice. But I was like, The Haunting, the book, and the movie, there is no investigation, which is pretty cool, actually. Yeah. They're never going to find out the real cause of the haunting. They're never going to find out, here's the way you stop the haunting. It is continuously ambiguous, and the haunting wants something, but you never really know why. It doesn't make sense or anything. The changeling has more of a, like, it is kind of novelistic of like, hey, here's... This is a problem. We discover the problem, and then there's a cure for the problem.
And as it turns out, the title is based around the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of those, like, what the fuck does this title mean? And then it's like, oh.
Yeah. Finally says it to the senator.
So the meaning of the changeling, so it's defined as being one of two things. One is a creature found in European folklore and folk religion. It described as being the offspring of a fairy, troll, elf, or other legendary creature that has been secretly left in the place of a human child. And then sometimes it means a child who was taken. So in this case...
Well, I actually wrote a novel about this.
You wrote a novel about Liam Neeson?
About Liam Neeson's?
Yeah, about people who are taken?
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Okay, good.
Neeson wasn't taken.
No,
that's
nobody.
Part four, maybe.
Even by wolves, he wasn't taken.
I have a certain set of skills. I will get myself out of this.
Yeah, one of the skills is breaking tiny airport bottles of booze on his knuckles to fight wolves. Fuck, I wish he had said that in the first Taken, because it would have been like, oh, interesting.
Let's not fuck with this guy. Jeez, let's give his daughter back. No, but yeah, so a changeling, essentially how changelings work in most folklore is this changeling is born. They are an awful, terrible things that scream and gnash and try to kill their mother and psychically drain their mother. And so fairies would typically get rid of them as soon as they could. And how they would get rid of them is go and exchange them for other people's children.
And they would only become a changeling once they were changed for... That's what makes them the changeling, right? When they're... They're changed for the human child.
No, they can actually look like other things.
Ah.
And so when you exchange the child, it starts looking like the child.
Do you have to have the receipt?
You do not have to have
you
the
don't?
Receipt.
Okay,
but so this was an explanation, you know, in olden times for why children would have sharp changes in personality, why they would start getting sick, why they would be awful.
Grow boobies.
I was going to say adolescence is defined in a lot of cultures as someone switched the child.
No. Like even as a baby, like,
holy
you know,
fuck.
Yeah. No, there's like, yeah. And so you'd have these children that would be like these awful demonic children. And clearly the thing was, is their good, innocent child that God gave them was taken by fairies. And we were left with this thing.
Did you ever say this to your wife? When your infant acted up, that it was abducted by fairies and a replacement was left?
I did, yeah, all the time. Yeah. All right. I just tell that to my child.
As long as that is standard operating procedure, I'll be just fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in this particular case, what we find out in the course of this movie is that this child was sick, was ill, but this guy wanted to leave his legacy, wanted someone to, you know, inherit everything he'd built so it didn't just go away. And so he replaced his own child after he murdered his child.
You know what's crazy about a lot of horror movies? They don't look kindly on turn-of-the-century industrialists. There aren't a lot of turn-of-the-century industrialists that come out clean in the wash, as it turns out with a lot of these.
No. Apparently, capitalism at certain points in history is not so bueno.
Yeah, it is the horror. So yeah, so he murders his child, drowns his child. It's shown pretty graphically.
It's a pretty disturbing fucking scene.
Yeah,
it
is. Then he adopts a child, secretly takes this child to Europe, pretending it's his crippled child, and then said, "Oh my gosh, Europe did wonders for children." Because, you know, Europe has a national health care. And the child comes back and is able to walk and becomes a pretty great guy.
This is an era not only before the internet, it's before radio, it's before television. Like, all you know is what you get in the newspaper. And at this point in history, the newspaper reported that people saw little green men through telescopes on Mars. Like this is, they would print almost everything.
Yeah, thank God we moved out of that era, right?
Yeah,
no more fake news now.
Fake news! magical cures were always coming out of Europe. So going to some spa in Europe and coming back, you know, women did this all the time. Like, teen girls were mysteriously sent away and then came back 9-10 months later feeling much better.
This was a period when Lord wasn't an artist you tolerated on the radio, but a place that cured ailments, as it turns out.
And so the idea of going to Europe to look for a cure for his son, to come back to find out he's cured. People were like, "Oh yeah," and "Oh, we haven't seen, you know, your son in 10 years." And "Oh, look, he looks fantastic. He looks fabu."
Yeah. Now here's an interesting take on the film. So for those of you who haven't seen the film, then that son, the changeling, he who grows up as this rich man's son, he inherits this empire, becomes a senator. He becomes actually a Democrat. No. Maybe I can't remember if he's a Democrat or Republican.
Well, he's evil, so he must be a Democrat.
But he's not evil in it, right? That's the weird thing. He's kind of a good guy. He's supporting the arts. We see him. He's always giving to things. Like,
yeah, he's not actually... That's the weird thing about this movie, is he's not a terrible human being.
Nor do we believe, it's not implied, that he knows anything about any of this.
I disagree. You get the definite concept at the end of the movie that he did know what was going on.
You think
on.
So? I think it's really ambiguous.
I do think he knows.
See, I actually don't think he knew. I think once he was presented with the evidence, it made sense to him and he refused to believe it.
Yeah.
But I don't believe that he actually thought. Like, I do believe, like, that this actor's name is Melvin Douglas. And the reason I know this is that the same year he's also in Ghost Story, which is a movie that, stay tuned, take a drink. There's no way we're not going to cover this movie.
Speaking of 80s movies that feel like 70s movies.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And speaking of 80s movies populated with geriatric actors.
Oh, that Ghost Story is based on another one based on a novel.
Yes.
Really great. We will at some point cover Ghost Story.
Oh, terrified me as a kid.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Like, my dad used to quote that movie, and I didn't know what it was from, and I thought my dad was just saying creepy shit. learned years
Come
later.
To Uncle Touchy's Puzzle Dungeon.
No, not Uncle Touchy. He would say things like, "Dad's with me, you toad," and, like, you know, all these things that came from that movie. But Melvin Douglas, the last two movies he was ever in were Ghost Story and this, The Changeling. His reaction when George C. Scott confronts him with the information that your father murdered your brother or murdered his original son and then adopted you, and his reaction to that is so, like, "How dare you accuse my loving father?" And he breaks into tears. Like, I don't believe he knew it at all. And I think that's what makes the ending of this movie so powerful, and this weird sort of out-of-body supernatural experience so potent, is that this character didn't know what a complete bastard his father was. And we have a character whose entire world is falling down around him, and it's separate from the character who's had to kind of dig up literally all of his information.
That is a really interesting take. I've never read it that way. I've always read it that he knew and he was denying it.
Well,
that he did not want to admit it.
He's looking at the two St. Christopher medals, And he literally just cannot believe that both of those... In fact, his first reaction when George C. Scott is waving the St. Christopher Medal at the airport is, that's mine, how did he get it? And then when he gets on the plane, he literally reaches in his shirt like, oh wait, I have mine. Like, he cannot wrap, he can't reconcile this new information around what he's known his whole life. So, and I think that's what's really interesting about this movie is it doesn't set out to make... Again, a movie made in the late 70s that gets released in the early 80s is not setting out to make a U.S. senator the villain, despite the fact that they easily could have. He's not actually a bad guy, but he cannot wrap his head around the information that he's presented with when George C. Scott comes to his house.
And that makes it, like, really, like, that take on the ending thing makes it really interesting because then, right, he puts the murdered child's St. Christopher medal around the portrait of his father. His desk starts to shake. And then he has that out-of-body thing you're talking about where he simultaneously seems to be dying of a heart attack in his own office while simultaneously walking up the steps of the burning haunted house and into the attic where the child was murdered at the same time. So it was like, you could read it as like, he sacrificed himself to end the haunting and put this restless spirit... to, at peace? And that's what Democrats do, Cargo. they give themselves.
I think that's what John Kerry's platform was, wasn't it? It's like, I'll put to bed all the hauntings in this country. But you're very much correct on that. And what I think is interesting about that is if you are renting a house, another pro tip, we're going to dive into pro tip number two. If you're renting a house at any point in your life and there is a walled up portion of a staircase or a secret room, don't fucking rent that house. I don't know why I have to tell people this. If you invest in a home, it's like, oh, what's this? A secret room? Don't take that house. Get out immediately.
That is good advice.
I don't know. A secret room, it could be a good composition room. Could possibly happen.
So many wrong things could happen. I'm
surprised that that's where you go. I would draw the line at do not rent a house that has child wheelchairs upstairs.
And how do you know they're child wheelchairs? Because you have to rip down the wall and find the hidden attic room with the extra window, like, oh, here's a little kid's room. I'm sorry, anything Victorian is haunted. Can we just, I'm sorry to, like, generalize, but if you live in a house with anything Victorian, get the fuck out of that house.
But, you know, that's George C. Scott, and this is so cool, because he is kind of a badass, and we've seen him like, well, you know what, I just went through the worst thing ever. I just went through the worst thing ever. And then, like, things are happening, haunted house stuff, that thing happening, he's like, gosh, man. I maybe should leave. But you know what? Instead, I'm going to stick around. Maybe hire someone to do a seance. Like, he doesn't leave, and he has no reason to stay. He's just renting the place. There's nothing forcing him to stay, except, like, what you're saying, Cargill, is, like, his grief is like, you know what? I'm going to channel my grief into figuring out why there's something haunting this house.
Yeah. And can we just, for a moment, talk about a scene that we just... We've talked about the ball scene. We've talked about, you know, the scene with the kid's wheelchair. But really, the really great creepy powerhouse scene in this movie is the fucking seance.
Yeah.
And the seance is just one of those unbelievably just great inspired moments in this film.
So when anyone writes a haunted house film at this point, present company excluded because it didn't really apply... Is that the thing you write around? Do you start with the seance and work your way backwards? Do you know what I mean? Because it's such a formidable part of a haunted house movie.
They're now telling... I don't know what you've heard. You've heard is don't do a seance.
Really?
Yeah, it's been done.
Oh, not anymore. Well, you can't. Like, it's been done so many times. Hell, they just built two entire movies around it.
We're calling you out.
The Legion movies. Done by our friend Jason Blum.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I will rephrase. You hear that, Ouija? We're calling you out.
Because apparently...
Is that played out? Y-E-S. Yes, it is.
So this particular seance, though, this is my favorite seance of all time. Like this scene right here where they do the seance and they're recording it on what at the time, and this is the beauty of just when this movie was made, like this house, this Victorian era house, was just old enough to still be considered the type of place you would move into without being too old. And they are listening to, they are recording the seance on reel to reel because
he's a composer and he has that there.
Yeah. And that's when you want high quality recording, you use reel to reel in 1980. And holy shit, them recording this and then playing back and hearing the kids whisper on that fucking recording is so well done.
Yeah. And how much did this influence Spanish filmmakers for years to come? I mean, between The Others, between J.A. Bayona doing The Orphanage, like, clearly this was an influence.
And
I love the fact that he is, that George C. Scott is a composer to give a natural reason why they have this technology.
Insidious, James Wan again borrows it in Insidious.
And Insidious does a great job.
What James Wan does in that particular scene by making it comedy and giving us those guys like who we have in The Changeling, but kind of going, what if we made them zany? What if we made it like Tony Randall and
Lee Whannell?
And Lee Whannell.
The new Odd Couple, Tony Randall and Lee Whannell.
Because it actually is Lee Whannell, who co-wrote the movie in that scene. So that's done really well. But here, like, this sequence is so creepy and iconic. Like, it's the thing about this movie, man, is this movie has so many great scenes where it's like, there isn't that one moment. There are several moments, and there are several things that they do that make the entire thing worthwhile and make it work. You've got, you know, the banging on the pipes at 6 a.m. every morning and what that pays off to, and the wheelchair and the ball. And he goes and he throws the fucking ball off the bridge. He's like, fuck you, ball. And the ball comes back. Fuck you. And then, of course, we have this scene, and it's just every bit of this together. There is not a single bit of horror in this movie that is so dated that you're like, you have to forgive this. Like, the one thing that we've talked about, the one element of this movie that you have to say when you're turning people on to it is the base story of it. This is a Stir of Echoes. This is a story where a guy is going to try to solve a mystery for a ghost. It's going to start off with the ghost as the antagonist, and then the ghost is actually going to become the center of the hero's journey. To speak of the hero's journey, one of the things I was so excited, because we've got Owen on. We have not talked about this yet, but we've got Owen on this week because he wrote a screenplay for a movie that is coming out very shortly. Called
The Axe Murders of Villisca.
Ah, so it's a love story.
Thank you for saving me having to pronounce that last word. I appreciate it.
It's a romantic comedy, yes. Clearly. But so
Under the Villiscan Sun. It's great. I think Kate Hudson's in it. It's
so amazing. Oddly enough, we have a mutual friend who's, you know, working with the company distributing it saying, hey, Cargill Brian, you want to have Owen on? We're like, of course we want to have Owen on. And he's like, well, there's a reason. I'm like, we don't need a reason to have Owen on. They're like, no, there's a reason. He wrote this movie, and we're like, okay, well, we were gonna see it anyway. It's Owen's fucking movie. So we were like, well, what movie would you like to do for this week? And you named a couple of movies, and I was just like, before Brian could even answer, I was just like, The Changeling, done. Which, for those of you that don't know, I am one of the worst people in the world for responding to any email whatsoever. Sure. It's one of those things that people who know me really well know that you need to email my wife, and she will come in and go, did you send that email back to Brian? But the minute I get this email, I'm like, The Changeling, we're doing The Changeling. And Brian's like, I guess we're doing The Changeling. And it is a movie that, I have a strong connection to, not only from my video store days of selling people on it, but when I was writing Sinister, there was a moment in which Scott and I had two very different views of what this movie should be. And we were trying to work through that. And this was our first big, you know, challenge as writers together. And we're like, how do we conquer? Like, you want to make this movie. I want to make this movie. What do we do here? And while we're talking about it, I'm like, you know what we need to fucking make? And he goes, what? I go, have you ever seen a movie called The Changeling? And he goes, with George C. Scott? And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, that's what this fucking movie is. The movie is about this horror told from the point of view of one guy. And so from that moment on, that's where we zeroed in on the idea that we're with Ethan Hawke the whole movie, that we are experiencing his journey, not the horror of the rest of the family. We're not seeing the other creepy things the family's encountering, only this character. And that's where we zeroed in. We talked for like half an hour about how much we love The Changeling. That went a lot like this conversation is here. And then, oddly enough, after we made Sinister, we got a call from a company going, hey, we were wondering if you guys wanted to make a movie with us. And we were like, well, what movie? And they're like, we were working on a remake of The Changeling. And it's like, are you fucking kidding me?
And then Clint Eastwood's like, no, I bet you do that.
Yeah, yeah, Clint Eastwood,
Angelina
thanks.
Angelina Jolie as George C. Scott.
No, so here's the reason I brought this up. This is not just a, hey, another one of those, hey, here's a movie Cargill almost made stories. What ended up happening was we were like, hell yes. Like, this is a movie that Guillermo del Toro tried to get made, and he had problems, and we didn't know what problems he had. And this was a movie being made by Dark Castle, which still existed at the time. They had not, it was just before they collapsed. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a thing that happened. This was not, but that wasn't why this didn't happen. What happened was we waited for 10 weeks, 10 weeks after saying, yes, we want to do this. We have read over the drafts that have existed. We have come up with our ideas. Me and Scott are bouncing back and forth. We have not written a word because we haven't been commissioned yet. We don't know it's a guaranteed thing. And we call like once a week and we're like, what is going on with this movie? And our people keep calling and they're like, we don't know. We can't get a straight answer. And 10 weeks in, 10 weeks after we've said, yes, we want this movie, we get a call going, okay, so here's the thing. We don't have the rights.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, no. No, here's the thing is, we have one of the people who has the rights, who wants us to make this movie. But the problem is there's more than one person that needs to sign off on the rights. And one of those people is in jail for fraud. So he's not legally allowed to sign any legal forms whatsoever.
Whoa.
So the whole reason there isn't a Changeling remake by me and Scott is because one of the people who originally produced or owns the rights to the Changeling, which is probably why, and the reason I bring this up, probably why there's not a Blu-ray of it, probably why you cannot find it on streaming, is because at one point in 2012, that I know for certain, one of the people who had the rights to this movie could not legally sign anything because they were in prison for fraud.
I just love the point in all of his stories where it diverges from, this is why we didn't remake Blind Fury. So this is the point.
Also a true story.
Why we didn't remake Blind Fury. So
we really wanted to make Blind Fury. Nobody could find who has the rights to Blind Fury. I would still love to remake Blind Fury. Holy God, Blind Fury.
No, I don't disagree with you. It's just funny to me. Like, this is the one divergence from this is why we didn't remake Blind Fury. Oh, in jail for fraud. But the thing that always like gets me about this movie, and the reason I had difficulty sleeping last night, is the sound and score.
Yeah.
The sound design and the score of this movie. The sound design, at first, when you first hear the little kids' sort of 80-yard lines, you might think, oh, this is outdated. This is a little bit, you know, a cliche, whatever. But by the 15th time you hear, my metal, where's
my metal, daddy.
And then when you see the horrificness of the actual murder of this child, that becomes really unsettling. And then the music, because they tie into the fact that George C. Scott is a composer, and the lullaby that he hears that ends up being the same as the music box in the attic, and
he's writing as a composition.
Yeah, yes. And they do things like, that's what's so brilliant about this movie. They do this, the first indication that there's something wrong in this house is he's playing the piano. He moves away from the piano, and one key goes down.
Bing!
Yeah, which would be creepy in and of itself, but then the score kind of enhances that to the point where you can't tell whether the music you're hearing is diegetic to what's actually happening in the movie. Is it something that characters in the house should be hearing, or is it just the score? They create this vague delineation between the score of the movie and music that's actually being played in the movie.
Oh, yeah. That's a really cool observation. Like, that moment when that piano goes, bing, really gets me too. And I hadn't thought about it in its relation to the score. But there is this cool thing. Like, the pacing of the movie is, as we said, is like really steady and haunting and hypnotic in the way that The Shining or even The Omen is.
Yes.
And I really love that, especially watching it the second time. I'm, as a writer, I kind of tend to like, can we get to like the crazy stuff really fast? And this does a beautiful job of like, it's going to give you a shocking opening and then go, hey, you know what? Now for about 20 minutes, you're just going to see a real sad guy. And he's going to be moving into a house, and he's going to be pretty sad. And but it has these quick, great moments where you're like, he's alone and really sad, and then he's in front of a crowd of 400 in a lecture, and he's really sad, and then he's back home, and then the haunting starts. And you're right, it's almost like the pace is like musical, like goong, 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 like getting bigger and bigger and starting with subtle things and then being underscored, and yeah, it's freaky.
Well, he has a line in this movie that I don't think is accidental where he says, you know, I'm having a lot of trouble with the second movement. The second act of this movie is where the creepiest shit happens. I don't think that's accidental. I think that's basically a clue into the audience that pay attention because the second act of this movie is where things are going to get real creepy because that's not only where we have the seance, but that's where we find out that there is a secondary haunting location.
Yes!
Talk about something that doesn't happen in a lot of contemporary haunting movies.
We go to another house.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, this other house was owned by this family as well, and the little girl who lives there is experiencing supernatural occurrences.
Oh, no, no. It's not that the house was owned by somebody else. It's that the house is built above a well where the body was thrown.
But the house itself that sits above that well was also owned by the family that owns the house that George C. Scott is in. So it is like a literal secondary haunting location.
There could have been there's a little girl who's in a room, and the child that has been murdered has been dropped down this well, and this is, you know, 100 years before, not 100, but like 80, 70 years before the action of the film. And the little girl lives in this room, is having nightmares about a child, gnome-like is the description her mother gives, gnome-like, crawling through the floorboards and crying out to her. I'm like, holy crap, that's scary as hell. And she's like, eventually is like, yeah, rip up my floorboards.
Yeah, this poor little girl who's like, I don't know why my parents got this place so cheap, but you can fucking rip the hell out of my floorboards because I want this solved. And that is, of course, where George C. Scott discovers the remains of the little boy and of the original Carmichael child. And to me, is so unsettling because it's like, not only is George C. Scott facing the haunting in his own house, this crime, this transgression expands out to this entire town.
Which is another way, like, this movie does that investigation well. In the same way, like, the haunting doesn't need to do it. It's all in the house. It's all internal. This one is like, the guy's almost becomes a detective. It's like, I'm a composer, but I'm going to become a detective for a while. He starts lying to the cops, like, I don't know who that could be. And then he sneaks back into the scene after hours to try and find the medal. And then he's become a detective. And this kind of a noir detective kind of fun feel that drives.
Oh, especially to the third act of this movie.
Yeah. Oh, in the third act, for sure.
The third act, I mean, that's very much what, like, right down to the scene where he's like running at the senator on the tarmac and he's being held back and he's screaming and he's like, you've got to hear me out. You've got to listen to me.
Yeah. And it's funny you guys mentioned noir because the ending of this movie and the revelation actually reminded me less of a horror film and more of Chinatown.
Yeah.
Like, that was the biggest, like, reference point that I got.
It's kind of a downer of a fucking ending.
Right, because Chinatown has this ending where you're just like, I kind of didn't want the detective to find this out. Like, if that was going to be the end result, I didn't want this mystery to be solved. And it's kind of the same thing with the ending of this movie. You're just like, ooh, that's so much worse than I could have possibly imagined.
Yeah, but then all the special effects are in that third act too. Like the fire going along the stairway banister and the crazy, you know, wheelchair.
The medallion creeping out of the
mud. What do you want from me?
Yeah. I've done everything I can. What do you want? Now I'm just thinking of Rescuers Down Under again.
Yeah. So let's, for a moment, I just want to bring up the director of this. Like, we keep talking around the director. We keep referring to, like, Richard Donner-esque nature of it. It's Peter Medak.
Medak, yeah.
And this is his best film.
Oh, without a doubt.
Now, the thing is he's done some other junk food classics. Like, to not mention them would just not be right, because he did do such films as Species 2, Romeo is Bleeding, which is a really cool kind of overlooked, bizarre, oddball movie from its era. And then he did a whole bunch of television,
including episodes of Hannibal, including episodes of Cold Case, Breaking Bad, I mean, some of the biggest
Kindred
shows
the Embraced, which was a 6-episode series in the 90s based on the Vampire the Masquerade. Like, that was the attempt to make Vampire the Masquerade mainstream. Fox did a 6-episode TV series based on Vampire the Masquerade, and it was called Kindred the Embraced, and he did an episode of that.
It's this weird sort of double standard where I feel like sometimes we tend to judge people who start off in feature films and then move to television. But when you're somebody like Peter Medak, who started in feature films and then moved to shows like, I don't know, The Wire, House, Breaking Bad, Hannibal, like the biggest fucking best shows on television, like that's not a step down.
No, no. He's one of those guys who did feature films who couldn't get the right feature films after that. And was clearly, someone like who made The Changeling should not have ended up on Species 2. Like, that's just what happens sometimes. You make some films, like films we didn't mention that never connected, that nobody's bothered to see, that you read the reviews of, and people, you know, have seen it shrug and go, you can skip that one. So it's, you end up falling into that hole, and then eventually TV opens up, and you get somebody as talented as the guy who made this fucking movie. Because this is, in my estimation, my humble estimation, a masterpiece.
I'm sorry. Say that one more time.
My humble estimation.
There's a word there I don't.
Humble.
There it is. Okay.
Yes. In my humble estimation, this is a modern horror masterpiece. Like, this is a movie that has not gotten, like, that was part of the reason me and Scott agreed to even do the remake, was we knew what it meant is it would shine a light on the original.
Yeah.
And that we would get a chance to step out and say, you guys really need to check out this original movie. Like, this movie's fucking amazing. The reason we are the writers and Scott is the director he is because of this fucking movie, that it has been in our DNA for so long. This is a movie that is a masterpiece and just is not recognized as such. And I believe because it's a 1980 movie that isn't bam, 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 bam like the rest of 1980 movies. Like, it is not a fast-paced movie. This is a movie that feels like it comes from the previous decade because it takes its time and has been digested by people who don't want to take their time. They want, they want to have a horror movie be jump, 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 jump. And on top of that, the story, once you've seen Stir of Echoes, once you've seen The Sixth Sense, it's like, oh, this is one of those stories. And to be perfectly honest, The Sixth Sense does the detective story better than. Stir of Echoes does the detective story better than. Both movies came 19 years later and they had the opportunity to, and man, do they do them better. But neither of them has the iconic scares that this movie does. Neither of them really gets the tone and the mood of such a vintage Victorian style ghost story as this does. This movie does all of that perfectly.
And part of the reason we wanted Owen on this episode, because he has written a movie called The Axe Murders of Villisca that you've mentioned to us partially was influenced by The Changeling.
Yeah, well, when we were talking about like what movies were kind of in the in my mind as I was writing it, this was definitely there, and The Haunting and some of the others that I mentioned to you guys. And the idea, a lot of it was like that we bring our own haunting with us. And so, yeah, when I was writing The Axe Murders of Villisca, and I was working with Tony, the director, he's very much was like, he had had this experience in this haunted house, and that was the origin of this whole story. Of like, I want to tell this story. Of like, I went to this haunted house where this awful crime had happened, but the most horrible thing was my own experiences. Like,
well, why don't you tell us what the film's about, and tell the audience so that they have a reason to go out and
I don't want to do that because people, people might go out and buy tickets.
No promotion on this fucking show.
I'm above that, Cargill. You make people go see Dr. Strange.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, that's something you've never done is self-promotion. That would
can I stop you right there? Being above something is not something either one of us are used to on this show, so we're not really sure what you're saying.
Well, good. There's this house in Villisca. There was an axe murder that happened a little over 100 years ago where in this small little house, someone came in and killed a father, a mother, their four children, and two younger children who were also visiting the house at the same time. They never found who.
So it's very much like In Cold Blood, but with an axe.
And in a much smaller. This was not a ranch. This was a small house, and they never caught the murderers. It's actually pretty horrific. And that house is one of the most documented haunting houses in haunted houses in America. One of the most frightening things actually was, like, we did a note session. They said, they hired me to write the story. And I was like, really excited and was writing it. I wrote my first draft. They go, great, we're going to do a note session, but we also want you to visit the house itself. So we're going to have you
tell them, fuck that.
I didn't. I was like, that's interesting. I should have, because they had me, the director, and one of the producers stay the night in the house. Like, there's no electricity in the house. We're just going to have you stay in the house. I'm like, and this is where the director was like, this is the house I stayed in. And I had such a freaky experience with me and two of my friends.
Why did
really
you not
horrific.
Say fuck that?
I, you know, part of it was definitely for me, it was like, I feel I owe it to the people who actually died in this house. Like, I actually went upstairs and, like, I'm going to go sleep alone after, like, at 4 in the morning. I'm going to go sleep alone in the room where some of these people died, because it's like, you know, if I'm actually doing this, if I'm typing their names, I owe it to them to at least fully be here in this place. It was scary.
Get out.
Were you trying to inherit this house? Why did you stay the night there? I'm so confused.
I don't understand.
They gave me some good notes. The ghosts were like, change the end of act two. Your third act is weak.
The dialogue is stilted. It's stilted.
Hey, now you're really working against promoting the film.
This is the notes session.
I'm going to get in trouble.
Look, we all get shit notes. Let's face it.
From the undead.
But yeah, Tony had had this wild experience being in this house, and he just wanted to tell that story. And a lot of it was of like, oh, you know what? When you go into a place that has had some crazy event happen or some dark past, that often we bring our own hauntings with us. And it kind of makes us open to the haunting of the past. Or, like in George C. Scott, there's a parallel between our lives and what happened in this horrific history of this place. So that's why, like, this, you know, this, the axe murders of Villisca met up with a changeling in my head.
And I have to say, I've seen it, and the creepiness factor and the tone of it definitely, to pay no small compliment to the movie, reminded me of The Changeling.
You're saying it's better than The Changeling. Thank you. That's a quote. We're going to put that on the poster.
Yeah,
I feel very bad about this. I have to admit that I did not get a chance to see the movie. I got the dates mixed up in my head. You didn't realize this coming in. Brian had to deal with this. I didn't know you guys were showing up tonight. I thought this was next Tuesday. So I literally 5 minutes before, I'd been trying to figure out what I was doing with my wife for dinner. Apparently the answer is scotch.
The answer is always scotch.
Like, the door knocks, and Jessica's, are you expecting anybody? And go, no, I guess it's a delivery. And then Brian walks in, and I'm like, what is that's not tonight. And Brian's like, are you fucking with me?
The professionalism of this podcast is untouchable.
Yeah,
untouchable.
I've been deep in a project that I'm working on, did not realize it, so I did not get a chance to watch this movie, but I'm actually really looking forward to it. And it goes on VOD and in select theaters when?
January 20th.
January 20th. And for those of you listening now, we're like, you're like, hey, I'm a friend of the show, Owen's a friend of the show, I like this guy's opinions, I wish I could watch something of his now. There is a film of his available right now, which both me and Brian have seen, and we do really, really, truly enjoy, called Follow. Like, not enjoy as... I remember the night Follow showed, and I showed up to the screening.
Yeah.
And this was the, you're a fellow Austinite, you're a friend, I'm going to show up and support your film. It's playing at a local festival, you sit down to watch it, and you're like, all right, please don't, you know, I recite my mantra, please don't suck, please don't suck, please don't suck. And it's a legitimately great film.
Hey,
I love
thanks.
Follow. It's great. Another friend of the show, Noah Segan, stars in it. Guy most of you know is Kid Blue from the movie Looper, who loves to come and hang out in Austin every once in a while. Really good show. That really good film. That's available on VOD now, right?
Yeah. You can it just got put on Amazon Prime, so you can watch it on Amazon
Prime. You can watch it for free now, Primies. Yeah. Yes, definitely check out Follow, and definitely check out The Axe Murders of Villisca when it comes out on January 20th.
I know, I'm excited about seeing it in the theater.
Is it playing here in town?
I don't know. I have to check.
You have to check, because if it is, then me and Jess are going to be there at the first showing with you, and we'll fucking watch the movie.
Yeah.
So speaking of things we're excited about that may also give us issues with our stomachs, The junk food pairing section that we've arrived at. Cargill has graciously agreed to take the lead on this particular junk food pairing, so take it away, sir.
Okay, so, this is literally one of those things where you're like, I'm stumped, and I'm like...
I was completely stumped. I'll throw it out there, just your ridicule, fine, bring it on. The only thing I could think of was Booberry, the creepiest of all cereals, and that's all I had to go on.
Which is fine, which is totally fine.
However, I have one too, though, but...
Oh,
but
yes, yes, this is good. This is good.
Mine is cheap and easy, but it allows me to do this. There is a famous story in which, and I won't mention what film it was, but George C. Scott was supposed to be in a movie, and he flew out to be there, you know, the night before he's supposed to be shooting. And he flies out and he lands and no one is there to pick him up at the airport. And he's like, what? Like, this is very simple. They schedule a flight. They have a person there, whether it be, you know, a stretch limo or a cabbie. Somebody is there. Mr. Scott, I am going to take you to your hotel. He has no idea. He stands there. He makes some phone calls. Can't get anybody on the phone, but he knows where his hotel is. So he's like, fuck it. He takes a cab and he goes to his hotel. And he checks into his hotel and he sits there and he makes another phone call to try to get somebody to find out what the fuck is going on. And there's nobody. So he goes down to the bar and he sits there at the bar for a moment and he says, hey, bartender, what's the best bottle of scotch you got in here? And bartender's like this. He goes, I'm going to take the whole bottle, put it on my room. And he's like, okay, Mr. Scott, whatever you want. He takes the bottle. He then leaves the bar. He grabs his stuff, takes a cab back to the airport, flies home, sends a letter to the production telling them they can go fuck themselves, does not appear in the movie, and keeps the bottle of scotch. So tonight, the junk food pairing with the changeling is a bottle of fine scotch, and I'm going to pimp the one that we're drinking right now that I opened for you guys, the Oban Distillers Reserve.
That was in the grand tradition of Cargill, the Paul Harvey of junk food pairings. Well done, that was, sir.
Yeah.
So watch this movie, drink a fine scotch, and enjoy the sound of George C. Scott typing a fuck you letter to someone who did not pick him up from the airport.
Wow. No, that's very good. I like that junk food pairing very much, especially since we are actually drinking scotch tonight. Yeah. So, Owen?
I don't want to. Do I have to follow that?
You know what, Owen? This is not the first time you've had to follow me.
Oh.
Best of luck.
Damn it.
And, I mean, isn't that why your movie's called Follow?
Yeah, it's called Follow Cargill was the original title.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah, sinister and then follow.
You know, I don't think you want to talk about what followed Sinister, do you?
Whoa! Oh, man. Wow. What are all these gloves doing on the floor?
Well, this is an hour into the podcast. Me and Owen have had a couple of scotches now, and this is what it's like to sit around and listen to me and Owen drink scotch.
We should probably start the podcast at this point.
Normally, but I didn't realize it was coming over. I was stone cold sober when you guys walked in the door.
Which is never how we like to do this podcast with Gargoyle Stone Cold Sober. So
if I'm stone cold sober, I might get the details correct. And that is something I'm not supposed to do.
We can't have it.
That's part of the reason people listen to this show is you make a drinking game out of the details Cargill gets wrong in his head.
The thing they never hear is you going, pause it, pause it, pause it, pause it, pause it. They don't hear that.
Once a show. Maybe once a show. The way you did that was like I do it three or four times. Every once in a while, I'm like, I need to pause this because my brain just broke and I've had a few too many beers. And I want to make sure I get this detail right because this is an important detail for what I'm going to talk about.
I appreciate that because it means that my editing job is not too easy.
Yes. Well, I mean, you just don't want to just upload it.
No.
You've got to cut a little bit of the fluff.
There's got to be effort involved. So, yeah. I think Owen is withdrawing his junk food pairing.
It's great to see two professionals at work. It's really
where?
Here? Wrong show, my friend. No. There are much better podcasts in this fucking city.
There are more professionals when you guys do choose your own pancake than there are here in this room right now. So Don't you worry about that. But as we said before, you can find Follow right now on Amazon Prime. Go do it. Go do it immediately. And then the Axe Murders of Alyska will be available imminently. Tell me again.
January 20th.
And Owen, one of my favorite people, one of the funniest people I know, where can we find you on social media? Yes. People are like, I dig this guy. I want to hear more of his ramblings on whatever it is he's talking about.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Owen _ Edgerton.
Spell that for everybody.
E-G-E-R-T-O-N. That's a good point. E-G-E-R-T-O-N. And I'm on Facebook. O-W-E-N-E-G-E-R-T-O-N. Yeah, find me there.
Congratulations on your recent Golden Globe for Loving. I thought that
Thank
was great.
Thank you.
wrong Edgerton? Is that the wrong Edgerton?
No, that's the wrong Edgerton. That's me too. Done a lot of stuff.
Well, there you go. If you want to find more of us, you can go to iTunes, go to Stitcher, Junk Food Cinema on Facebook, Junk Food Cinema on Twitter. If you really like the show, consider, I'm not opposed to this. I'm just going to throw it out there. Babies are expensive. So patreon.com/junkfoodcinema would be a great place for you to go and throw any extra shekels you have in the new year into the hat, because Jesus Christ, Owen will back me up on this. Like, a lot of money. These kids cost, right?
Until they get to like age 5 and start earning their way.
Ugh. What? So you guys don't just spend all of your money on Warhammer?
No, Marvel, Marvel paycheck? No, we don't.
I do. My second child's named Warhammer.
What are you doing? What? You're not helping, Owen. Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter, at MassaWyrm. That's MassaWyrm, where you can find tons of Trump urine jokes this week.
Hey-o!
Or on Facebook, facebook.com/MassaWyrm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at Bryguy Salisbury, or my Facebook page is facebook.com/Bryguy. No, it's not. It's Brian Salisbury Critic. Owen, thank you so much for being on the show this week.
Oh, really, thank you guys. I will come back anytime you want. Well, Scotch and talking about movies?
You know what? We haven't really discussed this yet, but you may want to stick around and join us for our Patreon episode here, where we'll randomly do something I'm sure that Brian's cooked up that I totally forgotten to look at the email
about.
I will
do it if only to support Brian's children.
Professionalism. So we just want to give a hearty toast and say thank you for joining us this week, and never ever ever go into the secret blocked off room in the attic, because what the fuck are you thinking? Get the hell out of the Victorian house.